Welcome back to Unreasonable. We're here at the Summit for Religious Freedom in Washington, D.C., hosted by Americans United. We're having a conversation with Brandon Wolf. Brandon is a nationally recognized gun safety and LGBTQ civil rights advocate who serves as National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign. A survivor of the Pulse nightclub shooting, he's the co-founder of the Drew Project, honoring his friend Drew Leonin. Did I pronounce that?
Leinonen,
who was killed in the attack, which works to empower youth and provide future leaders in the LGBTQ community funding for higher education. So I am just so impressed by your trajectory.
Thank you.
I'm moved by how much bravery it must take to translate tragedy into activism. Can you walk us through what it is about you or circumstances of your life that could help you overcome a circumstance such as you experienced to create change in the face of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a privilege and an honor to be able to do the work. I lost my mom when I was in middle school. I grew up in a town that didn't look like me or love like me. I'm a queer person of color in America, and I grew up in a rural place that didn't have a lot in common with me. And so I think resilience has always been a part of who I am. I've always had to be strong. I've always had to find a way to persevere and find hope and optimism in dark spaces. But the truth is that I think a lot of what you see for me today is the best parts of my best friend, Drew, who isn't here anymore. He's really, I think, the first person I met that taught me what unconditional love feels like. He's the first person who challenged me to love myself in my fullest form. He's one of the first people who believed that I could do anything I put my mind to. And when he was stolen from us at Pulse nightclub, I wanted to keep those things alive. I was deeply afraid that other people would never get to experience the joy and passion he had for making life good for other people. So I've tried to carry that on. When I was writing my memoir, I noted that I don't think I'm the protagonist in my own story. I think Drew is. I'm just the narrator. So again, I think so much of what you see today in my work is a reflection of the gift that he gave me.
Humility is something else I observe in your statement.
Thank you.
You know, you're able to do this without the ego. You're pursuing something greater than yourself.
Absolutely.
And that is, it's inspiring.
Thank you.
I think it's lovely that you're living two lives. You're living for him and you're doing what you want to do to get the work across. And it leads me to a question about how do we, when we are out talking to people about voting issues and about getting to the polls and about supporting the secular issues that we're here for today, how do we do that with people that are fed a language of spiritual warfare that basically just feeds them hate and fear? What are your best methods and what do you take away? What do you bring to the table for that?
You know, I think in politics, my boss said it really well the other day, and I think she was quoting someone else. So don't hold me to who originally said this, but that people seek belonging before they seek ideology. And we are in a place in this country and certainly around the world where people have a vacuum where that sense of belonging once was. I think a lot of the work that we have to do is to help people see themselves in our mission, in our values, and the things that we're trying to put forward and the ideas we have to make the world a better place and give people that sense of belonging. So much of what the Christian nationalist agenda bases itself on is scooping those people up who don't feel like they see themselves in the world or don't belong. People who are afraid that if they try to change, if they try to do better, they might make a mistake and be cast out from society. The Christian nationalist regime scoops them up and then fills them with ideology, right? It gives them a place to belong first before it then indoctrinates them in this idea that there's only one right way to be a human being. And so I do think that our toughest challenge is, if we truly believe in democracy, to invest in real democracy. And that means bringing everyone to the table. It means bringing people to the table like my dad, who disagree with me on a lot of things, and leaving them the space and grace to believe that they could belong in our vision of the future as well. Because the truth is, when we dismantle Christian nationalism, white Christian nationalism, when we dismantle systemic racism, when we dismantle patriarchy, everybody's life gets better. And that is our job, to articulate to people that you belong in the vision of the future we're creating too. I don't know that we've done that job well yet. I think that's the task for us in the future. But I do think it comes back to this idea that people seek out belonging before they seek out ideology.
That's a lovely way to look at it.
And I think it's profound. As Christina mentioned, we just came from an amazing presentation, a panel on which you spoke about social media communications. I was furiously scribbling down notes because you in particular were speaking to my mantra, which is, how do you translate communication? What is, you said, communications is a tool, not a strategy. And I appreciated that so much. Can you speak to your methodology? How do you address your followers, people who care about your work, and motivate them to take that next step? I think already you're alluding to the nature of how you have these conversations and the tactfulness that you have to approach, with which you have to approach them. What are some of your tactics?
I think there are a couple of jobs I see myself doing in this moment. It's part of the reason that I left the work in Florida and went to work here at the Human Rights Campaign, doing, you know, things nationally. And the first job I have is to help illuminate the ties that bind so many of our struggles, because I firmly believe that the white Christian nationalist movement agenda sets individual fires around the country to try to sap us of resources. They, you know, take on abortion rights here. They take on LGBTQ plus rights there. They take on curriculum over here. They take on DEI over there. And all of a sudden, we're all spread thin trying to put out these individual fires, so much so that we're not able to collectively tell a story about the fact that they're not actually individual fires at all. They're one big coordinated blaze, and we can never clearly identify the arsonist, right? And so I think part of my task is to, right, I set my goal first, and my goal is to teach people how all of these things are connected and who's responsible for them, so that they can then channel their collective power into combating the forces that are propelling this agenda, right? So I think then, once I have my goal, right, I'm trying to teach people, I'm trying to educate people, then my strategy is, I have to tell that story over and over and over again. Every time you think something is happening in isolation, I'm trying to tie it back to, here's why this matters to you and why it's connected to other things that are happening. So important. And then the second thing that I try to do as much as I can is give people the now what. Now that I've given you this information, now that you can see this thread that ties two seemingly unrelated issues together, now what do you do about it, right? Where do you gather? What information should you have to be able to share? Where can you send texts or make phone calls or knock on doors to push back on this kind of thing? That's the second job.
I had a feeling you were going there.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
That it's like, once you've equipped people, the now what is the most important part. And so some of the ways we've done that, right, is like, connecting things in Florida back to Ron DeSantis, who has been a mouthpiece for the Christian nationalist agenda, and then giving people the, okay, so what are you going to do about that agenda? Well, we got a Board of Medicine hearing coming up. We'd really love to see you there. Well, we've got a school board meeting in this community. We'd really love to see you there. This lawmaker is up for re-election. We're going to protest him at Miami Beach Pride. We'd love for you to march alongside his float with us. We turn that into activations that help people take on these power structures.
Speaking our language, right, Christina?
Oh, yeah. Tell me about Moms for Liberty and how...
absolutely nobody wants
this
to.
This could be an episode all of its own.
Well, you still live in Florida.
I don't. I moved here 6 months ago.
Oh, you're in D.C. now. Yeah. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you. The air breathes lighter without fascism, I'll tell you that.
Our condolences to all of our listeners currently living in Florida.
Florida's near and dear to my heart. Oh. Home forever.
We hold out hope for you.
So... Moms for Liberty. Yeah. My school board, our race is won all blue. Every race was straight blue.
In an area where things do not generally happen.
Okay. Very much like I live in an area in Delaware County, just outside of Philadelphia, that's the most rural part of our little spot. And our school board members were, you know, there were Moms for Liberty candidates running. And I do think that the negative press with Moms for Liberty, the way they just kind of took it too far. But I would love to hear about your thoughts on how quickly this organization just has dismantled into a piece of, like, it's a schism.
Yeah.
And they did it to themselves.
They did it to themselves.
And
overplayed their hand, might be the
answer. Can we take that same energy and do that to these other sects that are out there working too?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes, of course we can. I'd love a world where the Heritage Foundation and the ADF are next on our list to fracture. But I think in order to...
Those are beautiful words.
Thank you. It's my life's work.
Yep.
In order to understand the Moms for Liberty quandary, I think you have to understand where Moms for Liberty came from in the first place. Because what happened to Bridget Ziegler and what is happening to the organization around the country was kind of the expected outcome. That once people actually understood who this group of people really was, and what their agenda really was, that it was never really going to last very long, right? So Moms for Liberty really was birthed, first of all, as a revenge project from a woman who ran for the school board and lost in rural Florida. And so she created this sort of front for the, you know, Republican Party right-wing apparatus and called it grassroots. They call it this grassroots collection of parents who, you know, are advocating for parents' rights. But from the beginning, it was actually just a way to funnel Republican Party and right-wing dollars into a public face that tried to capture a bit of the fears and anxieties of parents, specifically during the COVID era, right? People were deeply concerned about masks and vaccine policy. And, you know, we were, as a nation, living in a state of turmoil, just like the rest of the world. And so the right-wing Christian nationalist apparatus built Moms for Liberty as their way of trying to capture these, you know, these families who are anxious and nervous about what's happening with COVID. And it started, they said, as this battle for parents' rights to not let their kids wear a mask or not make their kids get vaccinated. And very quickly, it became much more about the traditional Christian nationalist agenda, which is, you know, the suppression of LGBTQ plus identities, the suppression of American history and diversity, equity, and inclusion programming, right? It became very nakedly about this idea that freedom doesn't actually mean freedom for everyone. It means freedom to be one type of human being. And if you do not align yourself with that ideology, you will be cast out of society, right? So that is part of the understanding we have to know how Moms for Liberty unraveled, because those same people that they tried to scoop up in their net don't want any part of that second part of the agenda, right? Freedom actually means something to them. When they say parents' rights, they think you mean all parents' rights. And as soon as it becomes clear that it's only some parents' rights, they suddenly don't have an interest in what you're selling. And so the, you know, I just want my kid to not have to wear a mask at school became chaos at school board meetings. It became books being banned. It became, you know, curriculum being censored. And all of a sudden, parents were waking up to this reality that their kids' education was being hijacked. And I think a place where Moms for Liberty overplayed their hand is that, you know, school serves several functions, not just education. They take care of people's kids all day long while people are at work, while they're, you know, doing what they need to do around the house, taking care of a family member. And when school no longer becomes a place that you can rely on to send your kids to that will not be, you know, an agent of chaos, you are not interested in what is creating that chaos. It is disrupting your life to have Moms for Liberty, you know, digging everything up, tearing it up all the time. And so then we got to this place where very powerful, very public members of Moms for Liberty, not just Bridget, by the way, became embroiled in scandals that seemed at odds with the values that this organization was propelling. And I think for me, that was the most public signal that people had of what they thought was true all along, that these were a bunch of political operatives who don't give a damn about freedom. They don't give a damn about parental rights. They want power. They want money. They want control over government functions. And that's made obvious when you have the very same people who are trying to ban books about families with two moms filming content with, you know, their partners.
Yeah.
Multiple partners.
You know, my wife and I love to play bluffing games.
Okay.
And she wins all the time because she plays so honestly.
Yeah.
And I like to think, although this certainly isn't an apt analogy for poker and other bluffing games necessarily, but in my little microcosm here, I like to think it's an analogy for a bad faith organization like Moms for Liberty.
Right.
Enough bullshit people are eventually going to call you out on it. They're going to see through you.
That's
right. Going to spiral out of hand. It's going to become uncontrollable.
Yeah. You know, I'll just say that people ask me all the time, you know, what's the solution? How do we get more good people elected? And there are a lot of things we have to fix. Our, you know, election system is difficult if you're not someone who already has money and power to engage in. But I think on its face, it's actually kind of simple. People can smell bullshit.
Yeah.
They want someone who's real. They want someone who's authentic.
They're inherently cynical of the political system to begin with.
That's right. And so if they
people
see
are
someone
power,
if they see someone sitting across the table who looks like them, who represents the community, who has the same values, who speak in their language,
yeah,
all of a sudden they're more likely to engage and show up for that person than they are someone who's just peddling, you know, one thing out of one side of their mouth while they're engaging in other content on the other side of their mouth.
Sure. I had a personal question I wanted to ask, if you're willing to disclose this.
Sure.
I'm sitting here, again, very impressed by your poise and your eloquence and your ability to be strategic. As somebody who has faced real tragedy, I also say this from the perspective of a straight white cis male who's never had, you know, real justification to be angry. Certainly not on the level of somebody who has seen the things what you've experienced, what you've seen. How do you manage anger? How are you able to have conversations, for example, with your father, who, as you mentioned in your panel discussion, owns AR-15s? I mean, I can't imagine that isn't a sensitive issue.
Right.
I got angry hearing you talk about that.
Yeah.
How do you do it?
That's a really good question. I don't want to lie to folks and say that I don't experience anger.
Yeah.
I think, you know, everyone experiences anger. Certainly in this work, you know, again, I worked in Florida politics for a long time. There's no way you can go through that without getting angry. But I learned a long time ago from a mentor that if I allow anger to fuel my work, if that becomes my only source of fuel, then it's not sustainable, right? And I will burn out and I will not achieve the things that I'm trying to achieve. And so instead, I allow myself to be fueled by defiance. I allow myself to be fueled by hope and optimism. I allow myself to be fueled by the joy that I experience inside my community, the drag shows that I go to see, the pride festivals that I attend. Those are the things that actually fuel my dreams for the future. And I also think that's what has made movements so resilient over time, right? Not being fueled by momentary flashes of rage, but by this longer term outlook for what's possible. And what I mean by that is, you know, look at the queer civil rights movement. If you look at what people were experiencing during the HIV and AIDS epidemic, it was truly horrific. You know, millions of people dying while a government even refuses to acknowledge the pain that they were going through. There was the chance that those people could be fueled simply by rage. But that may have just been a flash in the pan. It certainly wouldn't have been sustainable. Instead, they were fueled by their love for one another, right? And they had these, you know, the ballroom scene was big and fabulous. They had these moments of joy that propelled them toward the idea that the world could be better. If you went back there and you told those same people in the ACT UP movement, who were disrupting people's funeral services and church services, if you told them that just decades later, we would have medication that prevents people from contracting HIV in the first place, and that through government subsidies, people could get it for free, they would not have imagined that possible. I guarantee you, they would not have comprehended it. But without knowing it, they were fighting for that world anyway. And they did it not simply because they were angry. They were certainly angry, but they did it because of the joy that they were experiencing with each other. They did it because of the love they had for one another. And so I challenge myself to be like those movements in the past and be fueled not simply by the moments of anger and rage that I feel, but by this longer term love that I have for the other people that I'm trying to make the world better for.
And you also made a comment during the panel discussion about getting to experience some of the joy for which you're
Absolutely.
Fighting.
Absolutely.
We're coming up on our time, so let's end on a positive
note. Okay.
Tell us some of the joys that you've experienced in this medium.
Oh my gosh, I experience joy every day, but there have been some really powerful moments. I experienced a lot of joy when I published my book, A Place for Us, and put it into the world. I cried a lot when I saw it on a shelf for the first time.
Sure.
It's a huge moment, and to be able to, you know, as a queer person of color who went to school not knowing if there was anyone else like me on planet Earth, to know that my story now can reach other queer young people is just, that's a huge moment of joy. And then I find joy in the little things. I find joy in, you know, being in an office full of other queer folks, many of whom are also young and of color, and getting to experience laughter with them in the office. I experience joy in going out with my friends and dancing and, you know, music and the arts. I think that part of our job, it is part of the work for us to experience that joy. That every time I go on vacation or I get a ticket to a museum or I go to see, you know, I love the symphony and the opera. So like going to see the opera, like being in that space, experiencing rest and relaxation in a world that tells me I can only be as valuable as what I can produce, that in itself is the work, right? That's the protest. That's the resistance that we're talking about. So I try to experience joy every day. I experience joy in so many places. And I love that you're ending on that because I want to challenge other people to do the same.
To share that optimism.
Which helps if you turn off your notifications. I love that. I love that you
turn
said
them
that.
Off.
Yes.
I actually have a do not disturb on my phone that's called Always. I changed the emoji to a smiley face. And it is totally customized to not bother me all of the things that are happening in the world.
Everyone should do that.
There was a world before cell phones where we did not feel the need to be so connected to people all the time. It's okay to turn your notifications
off. So you have a strategy for joy and optimism in your own mental health. Well, Brandon, you are an abject inspiration.
Thank you.
And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with us.